come join the conversation, the show that you've been wanting. Keep it real with no filter, weekly we share discussions. WWSD, interviewing creative guests, talking the creative process and sharing all the influences from TV and film. Emmy nominated and winning, yeah, they coming through. Actors and comedians too, directors and writers, way more than a few. Masters of their craft, yes, tune in, you gotta see. This the podcast that you need, WWSD.
Welcome to the WWSD podcast. Weekly, we share discussions with interesting and creative people. I'm your host, Josh, and as always, I'm joined by my buddy and co-host, Seamus. How are you doing tonight, Seamus?
I'm doing awesome, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
I mean, I'm excited for tonight. How about you?
Oh, I am very excited. We got a very, very cool guest.
Who is it?
Tonight, we are joined by Eric Pasoja. Eric has portrayed a recurring character on many hit TV shows, such as The Flight Attendant and NCIS. He's also played characters from two of my all-time favorite shows, such as Firefly and Doom Patrol. He's also done voice work for many video games, such as Red Dead Redemption 2, multiple Call of Duties, plus many more. He's also our second Yale graduate to appear on the show. Eric, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm actually curious, Seamus. It looks like you were drinking out of a urine specimen cup.
Oh, yeah. This is my mason jar that I drink out of.
That's great. Yes. Yeah. When you're done with a jam, you went right to lemonade. Good for you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't wash dishes. I like my water to have flavor, you know.
In South Florida, that's considered the nice China. So he's really busting it out for you.
Brought to you by Cascade.
It's got great capacity.
Yes, I can tell. Like, it's okay if you have to run to pee. Josh and I will vamp.
No, he doesn't need to run. He's got his jar right there. So yeah. It's a perfect system.
Loop the loop. I can sit here forever. This has gotten a little gross.
It's all right.
So Eric, how'd you get started in the industry?
It's really funny, actually. When I was 9 years old, I wanted to be a pitcher for the Yankees. Played a lot of ball. And one day, an agent showed up to my Little League game and asked my mom, hey, has he ever thought of doing commercials? And mom asked me and she said, hey, you could pay for college. I said, okay, why not? Like, I went to about 6 commercial auditions and said, this is not for me. I cannot do this. Ridiculous. And, you know, my mother at the time was an aeronautical engineer. She became a doctor. She was saving lives and then leaving to take me to commercial audition. That didn't really seem like apropos for a good life. So it wasn't really until college that I really fell in love with acting. And my first love is Shakespeare, actually. And that's where I really sort of cut my teeth. The first play I did in college at Yale was an original play written by William Wordsworth, the poet, called The Borderers. And it's kind of like the beginning of Pryor's career when he tried to do Cosby. Wordsworth so badly wanted to be Shakespeare. It's ridiculous. And I did this play. I had no idea what I was doing. But it started out a 4-year friendship mentorship with my advisor there, Murray Biggs. And he would just school me on Shakespeare for 4 years. And that's all right. Let me just rewind. I was in high school and people are going, I love this podcast. But one of my best friends and my parents and I went to a play off Broadway called Greater Tuna. And it's with 2 actors and 16 characters. It's hysterical. And they put it up at my high school. I'm like, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could audition for this. I love this play. And I did it. We did it with 4 actors and 16 characters because we were in high school. And quick changes, madcap. I remember sitting in the bathroom below the theater opening night and going through each of my characters. Like, hi, I'm Jody Buhmiller. I'm 8 years old. I'm really vulnerable. I found it really pretty. And I realized now that I was a method actor when I started. Like, the method was just for me. And I love the craft of acting from that point. And then when I get to college, it was all over. I was going to be a chem and theater major and then just a straight math and theater major. And finally, I went, screw it. Psychology and theater. That's it. People are like, you're going to be a psychiatrist? I'm like, I hate people. No. I did a psychoanalytic profile of Richard III. And then I played the role. That was my sort of journey through college. And then the business, I got done my senior year like this big main stage production, hundreds of people in the audience. And like a month later, I was in the East Village with like 14 people in the theater and a column in the middle of the stage. Just a war. It's just horrible. So that was the business when I first started. It's like anything I could do to get any kind of stage time in New York. I became a little fish in a big pond and I just, kept doing it.
How long were before you started comedy?
It's interesting. I did a bilingual tour of The Miser by Molière when I was 22. And we did all up and down the East Coast. And while I was on the road, I saw Aladdin. It had just come out in the theaters. And I saw Robin Williams, heard Robin Williams. And I said, this guy, he was my hero at the time, but he's having more fun than I've ever heard anyone have fun ever. And I want to see if I can do that. So while I was on the road, I wrote like 5 minutes of really bad material. And when I got back to New York, I just started jumping on open mics. And by the second open mic, first open mic, I used to do improv a lot. So improv was my thing. And I was part of an improv group and they had a show and they were like, all right, we're going to bring some comics on. And at one point, the guy who ran the show said, if anybody thinks, you know, you're funnier than these guys, go ahead and sign up. I was like, all right. So I had like 4 beers because I was just so nervous and I went up and that was it. That was it. 30-year journey right there.
So with that 5-minute set, were you doing like more Robin Williams, like voices and characters and stuff like that? Or were you actually telling like actual jokes?
It's funny. When I was 2 weeks into comedy, they started something called the Toyota Comedy Festival that year. And I waited in line for like 4 hours. I did this bit. My first bit I ever wrote was, I had a bad dream last night. I dreamt I was 22 years old, you know, and I was re-experiencing my circumcision and Darth Vader was the rabbi. You know, I was like, Baruch Atah Hashem. And okay. I did Yoda and I did C-3PO and I did R2. And I actually got a call back for the Toyota Comedy. And I was basically, you know, emulating Robin Williams for a long time, but I realized that he had something that nobody has. He had a photographic memory, an eidetic memory. He also had the ability to just have this cauldron of jokes and just pull them out at any time. I was never like that. That's not really who I am. I remember reading a book by Leonard Bernstein. Hey, am I all over the place today or what? Leonard Bernstein, and he had written a book about classical music. And he said the difference between Mozart and Beethoven is Mozart would pretty much write it down once and it was done. Beethoven would write and scratch and write and scratch and scribble and scratch. It's arguable who's better. And I'm not comparing myself to Mozart and Beethoven, but if you ask me, I'm more of like the Beethoven type.
When you got the bug for comedy, were you kind of 100% focused on that? Or were you still doing acting alongside of that?
I never stopped acting. Acting for me is just existing in the void on a level that is always, acting is really being of service. I believe acting is being of service to a playwright and a play and to a moment, to being responsible for the people that I'm on stage or on camera with. It is fully investing in someone else's life that I create and build and research and then moment to moment to moment to moment express it. So I never stopped doing that. I did plays in New York. I did acting classes, but it did shift to comedy, especially when I started really leaving the open mic circuit and going and doing spots. That sort of changed everything. The first person really to pass me was Esty at the Comedy Cellar. And nice. That is just my opinion, one of the best clubs on the planet. You name a great comedian, they've probably played there. I mean, right. For 4 months, Esty put me up between Dave Attell and Dave Chappelle every single night to make me strong.
That must have been insane, yeah.
Oh, it was great. And then, you know, Gotham Comedy Club was another one of my home clubs, the comic strip, Caroline's. I really became a comedian and started doing the road and I hated it. Oh my gosh. I'm not a guy who can live out of hotel rooms. I think it's because I'm a Cancer. I just like being home. But I loved comedy because it gave me the opportunity to write the script. And the thing about laughter is it is as honest a thing as there is in the world. It's hard to fake a laugh. There are two things. There's one thing that's impossible to fake. Another thing that's hard. Impossible to fake is a yawn. Go to a movie and watch when someone yawns and go, is this real or fake? 95% of the time you can tell it's fake. You know how you know it's real? It's when you start to yawn. That's when you know it's a real yawn. But otherwise, you know, you can't find it. The other one that's hard to do is a laugh. I mean, because if you're in front of, you know, 400 people, hopefully at least a quarter of them are going to laugh at your joke, if not the whole audience. And if not, you're just standing there going, oh, man. All right, hopefully the next one. You miss 2 or 3 and you're in a hole. You miss 5 and people start yelling at you. You miss 10 and then the hook comes, you know. It's actually quite an honest situation.
How's your, like, your acting kind of like shape your comedy career then? I mean, obviously you weren't really like stage for, like, you didn't have like the stage fright or anything. Like, was it like a really big boon doing all the theater stuff prior to comedy?
I'd say that. I was also a bit actory, and that's a danger when you do stand up. I think, you know, in a lot of situations, they want to see someone being a real person.
Oh, so you're like doing basically a monologue at first.
Kind of putting it on. You know, I was still developing my chops as an actor too, as opposed to, you know, just coming from the gut, which, I mean, unless you're just a moving target like Robin Williams was, or somebody who is a staggeringly brilliant improviser like Eddie Izzard, or you're willing to take things so far that nobody could possibly take them farther like Jim Carrey, that's sort of what I got into, but I had to find my true center first. Actually, part of the reason I started stand-up is so I could deal with stage fright.
Oh, okay.
I'd find that, you know, that fourth wall was a challenge to create, but once I started bringing the audience into my life and just kind of accepting that they were there and being able to talk to them, I didn't get into, believe me, you've done enough comedy, it's really hard to intimidate a comic with an audience. It's like, you know, besides two Norwegians and a stripper, I once had 98 of 100 college students get up and leave 20 minutes into my act.
Oh, wow.
I had to do 40 minutes for two people in order to get paid. I mean, unless you stab me, I don't care. I'll do it. I've been there. I'll turn it around. And by the way, those two people did laugh the entire time.
Yeah, you gained two fans.
Exactly. They're probably also too old for Instagram at this point. I know a lot of not just good comedians, great comedians. And it requires that you flex a muscle on a regular basis because crowds have energy. There's an energy going around, and to catch that wave requires a lot of practice, just being present with the moment. And it's hard if you haven't performed in 6 months.
Are you still getting up now?
I'm done. Things change. I realized, first of all, that I didn't love comedy as much as I thought I did. To be honest with you, I think part of it is because the audience has changed. If I were to start doing comedy again, I'd have to remove half of my act. I mean, I do impressions. That was part of it. Part of it was I fell in love with acting again on a big level. Well, first of all, COVID is the best thing ever to happen in my career, to be honest with you. I know there's been a lot of suffering, and I've lost, you know, friends. I've lost martial arts instructors. At the same time, being able to audition from home has changed everything because I'm 100% about the craft and being able to take my time, do my setup, glue my lines in my eye line, and actually do the, instead of spending 8 hours trying to pound these new lines in my head before showing up, I just paste things in my eye line. And I do the actual work an actor does. Who am I? Where am I? What am I? What do I want? Who am I talking to? Am I talking to one person? Where are they? Do all that work. And then I don't just get one shot in front of an amateur who's reading with me. Rather, I read with my friends from the actor's studio. I read with really talented folks. My wife, she's a terrific actor. And if I need to, I'll do 25 takes. That really made it fun. That made it a lot more fun. And then I was on the set of Hunters last year, and that's coming out in a bit. I was standing on this set and I thought, this is one of my favorite days I've ever had. I'd rather be on set than anywhere else. And so I just said, I'm just going to do this. Look, I know people who are famous comedians. You know, I know Dave. I know Bill Burr. I have other friends who are not famous comedians, are great. And they're on cruise ships. They're on the road all the time.
It's a hard lifestyle.
It's a hard lifestyle. And the beauty of, and it's also not a collaborative art. I'm telling you, if you're on a Steven Spielberg set, if you have shelves behind you and there's a little figurine on that shelf, you can bet your bottom dollar that someone obsessed about that figurine. That is the best figurine finder in the world. And those prop people or, you know, the set decorators or the production designers, man, they put their souls into this. So everybody is performing an important job. These things are meticulously thought out and executed by great minds and great talents. I want to be there. You know, I don't want to be at the Improv in Cleveland for a weekend for the second show on a Friday when everyone was out at work and now they're drunk and now they come in and have two more drinks and now they want to fight. Everyone has to face that. And heaven forbid I should say anything negative about, I'm going to say our former president's name. I do the Harry Potter thing. I call him Voldemort. You know, heaven forbid I bring him up on, you know, it's just gotten to the point where it wasn't fun. But acting, my gosh, I love it. I love it. I love making movies.
What was the last time you went on stage and performed for a comedy though?
It's funny you ask that question. Before COVID, I put my name in the hat for the Palm Springs Comedy Festival. I'm like, all right, what the hell? And I didn't hear from them. I'm like, okay, I figured they went another way. They got a hold of me like a year and a half later. They said, we didn't have it last year because of COVID. We're having it this year. Like, I hadn't been on stage for a year and a half. I'm like, all right. My wife and I, we drove down to Palm Springs and I'm about to go on stage and I give the MC my credits. He goes, no, I'm not taking credits. I said, why? He said, because I don't want to bias the judges. I said, judges? Is this a competition? Turns out I won the Palm Springs comedy competition. So yes, I have. I have been on stage since I quit. And I may go back on stage again. This is not a definitive no, but I'd much rather go on stage after doing a heck of a lot more acting. Because I got to tell you, man, I mean, over the past year, I've worked with some people that just make my heart sing. Working with Kaylee Cuoco makes my heart sing. Zosia Mamet, those folks. I mean, and then working with these Gary Cole. Here's what it is. There's a quote by Marianne Williamson. Sorry if I'm going to get deep for a moment.
No, please do.
That's fine.
But she said, we were born to make manifest the glory of God within us. And our job as artists is not look at me. Okay, Buddha once pointed to the moon and said, stop looking at my finger. Look at the moon. Our jobs as creatives are to be the messenger from our God selves. And so it's not look at me, look at me. It's like, look at what we're talking about. This is important. And if it really is important, I think art can change the world. So the question is, you know, what makes manifest the glory of God within us? I think there's some people who really find that through comedy. They really do. I mean, I look at some of the topics that all the way from Pryor to Carlin to my, you know, people like Bill Burr or Chappelle. Louis C.K., sorry, I know he's been banned, but I got to tell you, the reason he won an Emmy, in my opinion, for his last album is because the first 5 minutes of that set, he talked about the Descartesian relationship to believing in God or not. He actually went into the deepest philosophy and said, look, you're either going to believe in God or you're not, but when you die, you might as well believe in God because otherwise you never know. That was his premise. And then he took it, dissected it, made it hysterical, and basically gave the case for being religious. And like, that is, you know, he talks about Huckleberry Finn and having to read it to his kids and having to say the N-word. That is something pretty profound. And I appreciate when an artist can do that. And everybody on this planet is an animal. And so we have this empathic ability to understand things through story. And our job as actors, as a messenger, is to deliver that story from a very, very personal place. That's the most fun I could possibly have.
So you did mention you'd consider going back comedy after you do a little bit more acting. What would be like kind of like the definitive thing? Like, is it just like more of a time or do you want to do X amount of projects?
You really want me to go back to comedy, don't you? All right.
We got him.
Damn it. I would say this. I live in L.A. When I was in New York, I was doing 8 to 10 paid spots a week because I didn't want to do more. L.A. is a very different city for comedy. It is not the ideal place. Even people who are regulars on TV shows might get a spot at the Improv, and they have the audacity to pay $7 for a spot on the weekend. I used to MC at the Improv all the time. They pay $35 for that. Like, okay, so why am I doing this? Do I hope someone will see me and discuss? Whatever. I've done the Montreal Comedy Festival. I'm 52. It's not like someone needs to discover me. It's just, I'm going to do it because it's fun. And that's the thing, guys. You have to understand, I can tell how much fun you have doing this show. You could do anything you want with your lives. And you guys are sitting there looking like ZZ Top. Both of you have these big headphones on. All you have to do is like nod your head at the same time and you can be in a band. But instead, you're doing the WWSD podcast because it's fun for you guys. Mm-hmm. And like, I got to say, you know, anybody who is not having fun at their job, I feel really bad for them. Yeah, some people have day jobs. Okay, that's fine. But what's your passion? And you've clearly found yours and I found mine. If stand-up becomes fun, I'm like, you know what? All right, yeah, let's do a theater. It pays $20,000, $30,000 a weekend. Awesome. I guess I have to write some new material. Where am I going to go work it out? You know what? Better fly to New York for a few weeks and play a little bit. But I'm not going to do the bar / comedy club / tiny theater thing here in LA. You probably saw my Gotham set.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did that in New York. I had to perform it like, you know, we comics, we rehearse a lot. You know, every joke is carefully timed. Every word. Sometimes you put a word in there and it doesn't work. Sometimes we would write 4 pages of comedy and it comes out one line. Like I have a line, I'm an only child. Finally, and that's 4 words, but it came from like writing and writing and writing and writing. That was the funny part of it for me. So, you know, I had to perform at every back hole alley, freaking, you know, book show, open mic, comedy club, you know, drive all the way to the Ice House in Pasadena, do a set that just to get ready for it. It wasn't fun. Let me know when it's fun again. Let me know when I can make fun of everyone and everything without getting in trouble for it. And by the way, I don't aim down, but I like to take, I love poking fun at things that are sacred, you know, I do, and have a very spiritual life. And so, you know, that part of my comedy did come through, plus being vegan for 17 years. Well, I don't really like the term vegan. I prefer the term fascist.
Yeah, you're your third eye must be decalcified, huh?
Yeah, it's got glaucoma at this point.
So you mentioned something that you said acting is the best thing that allows you to exist in the void. Like, can you expound upon what you meant by that?
Yeah. When I say I love acting, like I'm passionate about it. When I'm not on set, I take 4 classes a week. Not because I want to give my power over to someone, it's because I want to try stuff. On Monday nights, I go to the actor's gym with 2-time Oscar winner Bobby Maresco. He won for Million Dollar Baby and Crash. We work on stuff. We even bring in writing pieces, acting pieces. On Wednesday, I study with Alan Miller. He was a contemporary of Elia Kazan. He studied with Lee Strasberg. Thursdays is Shakespeare with Richard Fancy, former language guy for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And Friday, I'm in session at the actor's studio, whether I'm working or commenting on my peers' work. The void is having no idea what's going to happen next, but know that at the end of your journey, even though you've gone completely off road, you are going to get to Kansas City and you left from St. Louis. So it's being off road. And here's what I mean. There is a wonderful scene in the movie Glory with Denzel Washington. It's really worth seeing. And he won an Oscar, Best Supporting Actor, for that role. Anybody who's seen this movie can't forget this moment. It's heartbreaking. He plays a really rebellious young guy under slavery during the Civil War. He's a soldier, and Matthew Broderick is whipping him. And you can see the look in his eyes of complete rebellion. And then as he gets hit, he just starts to break down, and he keeps trying to get strong. And this one tear comes down his eye. And you can tell that this is a person who's in great pain and is experiencing an incredible indignity. And you can't plan that tear. You can't. You have to live in the void. And by the way, he was also not being whipped, right? It's Denzel Washington, you know. Then again, he wasn't as Denzel as Denzel is, but he's an actor, you know. But what he was probably doing, I don't know what his process was really recognizing what a slave must have gone through and how much pain is embedded in the African-American psyche from just the worst in what humanity has to offer. He probably let himself go and thought, what does it feel like to be hit in the back like that? What does it feel like? And at some point, he just broke down. And the director said, cut, print, and then he moved on. And that may have been the 30-second take, because he's one of the great actors of our time. He probably did something different the time before that, something slightly different the time before that, et cetera. So acting is allowing a moment to happen, knowing that your training, your craft, your understanding of the story and your collaboration is going to work fine. And it's also the ability to say, you know what, this take isn't working, let's start. And that does happen. I mean, it happens with the best of them. The great Japanese swordsman, Miyamoto Musashi, wrote a book called The Book of Five Rings. And he had 5 elements, air, water, fire, and earth. And the 5th one was the void. And that void is where all good things come from. It's where also where all bad things come from. It is when Miles Davis would hear all this music around him and he'd just go, and then all this other music, and you're just like, what is that? What's going to happen next? And you know what? He doesn't know either, but he has the craft and time and talent and collaboration with his band so that when he goes, it's not even his song, but you know what I mean? Like, it takes years for that trust to happen. And it takes years of training. I do the martial arts too. Training your sword to strike like water, like air, like fire, like earth, to be able to go, what's really necessary in this moment? Do I want air? My opponent might be doing something weird. Do I block with air and strike with fire? What is it? The same thing as acting.
you've kind of found almost a medium for self-development. I'd say like the acting is part of that. And it sounds like it's also part of your spiritual development as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it seems like the passion you have for that kind of allows you to open those other dimensions of yourself through acting. Some people get into acting for other reasons too, right? Like some people get into acting for fame or for something else. And it's not necessarily so much about the craft. Do you think that passion is a door to this void or to these other like spiritual dimensions more so than the craft of acting?
There are a lot of people who want to be actors. Mm-hmm. Now, I was talking with one of the assistant directors on NCIS, and we shot on a Saturday once. He said, "Thanks for being here on a Saturday." I said, "Are you kidding? There are 1,000 actors behind me who would take my role in a second." There are a lot of people who want, if you want to be the best, and look, people are in this business for many different reasons. Passion is the only thing that sustains us in times of heartbreak. Because I got to tell you, man, there was a time about 10 years ago when I was staring at the ceiling at 1 o'clock in the morning. I was $125,000 in debt and I didn't know how I was going to get out of it. But I really wanted to be an actor still. I really wanted to do this. And the fact is, I can't see myself. Of course, I would do what it took to support my family. But here's why I want to be famous. Seriously. Here's why I want to be a big fat movie star next year. I want to work with the best people in the business, the greatest minds, the greatest spirits to create something bigger than we are. And I always say like this, look, if you want to be the fastest sprinter in the world, a lot of people want to be the fastest sprinters in the world. You not only have to have that level of talent, but you have to have that level of drive. You have to be surrounded. These days, you can't just do it by yourself. You need a guy who's like constantly putting electrodes on you and looking at your form and seeing if your form is breaking down or if you're running a certain way that's going to hurt your knee in a year, you won't be able to compete anymore. All that stuff. It takes a whole team now to create a great athlete. You're not just going to show up and sprint faster than Usain Bolt. It's not going to happen. I don't care how talented you are. In acting, I got to tell you, there are millions of actors, literally, probably millions of actors in the
world. New ones being born every day as well.
Right. And the way I see it like this is, I've been saying this for a few years. If you were a rookie point guard in the 1990s, at some point, you're going to face Michael Jordan. And people are going to say one of three things to you. One, Michael Jordan just took him to school. Number two, he's sort of holding his own. Or holy crap, who just stole the ball from Michael Jordan? Do you think anything but passion is going to get you to three? No, not going to happen. So, that said, I do the work because I love it. And that's infectious. And it's also predictably unpredictable, meaning that this is where craft comes in. I know what I did to get ready for this, but I don't know what happened. He's just got that void going. It is also a very spiritual journey. And if you want to be a star because you want to be famous, if you want your family to be bothered while you're eating at a restaurant, or, if you want all the women and the money and everything else, that's okay. But there'll come a point when you realize that you've wasted your life. Because at some point, it's funny, someone once asked me, how do I become national champion in Shotokan karate? Someone asked me this because, I trained a very long time. I lived in Japan. And I said, well, keep this in mind. The end result of all of this is death. 30 years from now, if you're national champion, you will be in a list of national champions. And someone will read down it, not know your name, and keep reading. It means nothing to anybody. It meant to you at the time. I guarantee you, you can't tell me offhand, maybe some of our listeners could, who won the Oscar for Best Actor in 1975. Going to have to look it up on the Wikipedia.
I'm trying to think what came out in 75.
Exactly. It wasn't Godfather, right?
Right. Yeah. Godfather, I think. Yeah. That's the thing. You're going to have to look it up. Nobody knows. Is that what you want to be? You want to be that guy? Or one of my great acting teachers, Eric Morris, said, if you want to live forever, you got to write. And they may not remember who you are, but they'll remember the story that you created.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope you're passionate about it. I love not knowing what's going to happen next. That's what separates my job from a 9-to-5.
You went to theater school. You were doing a bunch of plays in New York. You were doing comedy. When did that transition to like television and film and all that? Like, what was that process?
It's really interesting. This is a fun story. I moved out here in 1999. And in 2000, I had an audition for an ABC movie of the week called The Beach Boys, An American Family. And I was auditioning for the role of Charles Manson. And those of you who don't know, Dennis Wilson was driving down the highway in his Ferrari convertible one day, and he picked up these two gorgeous hippie girls, took them home, had a threesome, said, hey, gals, I gotta go to band practice. Make yourselves at home. And when he got back at 2 a.m, the Manson family had made themselves at home. So he got involved with Charlie for a while. So I had this audition, and then I flew to New York, did a spot at Caroline's, and then was slated to do 5 colleges in North Carolina. So I left, did Caroline's. I rented a car at Newark, drove down. I was in the middle of my third school, and I got a call. Hey, you have a callback. I took my rental car. I drove to the airport. I flew all the way back to LA. I rented a car, went to the audition, got back in my rental car, returned it, flew all the way back to the East Coast and all the way back to North Carolina, and I booked the role. And it was, I can't even tell you how much fun it was. First of all, I'd like to joke that I've played more serial killers than there've been serial killers. And I've played Nazis longer than World War II happened. And I'm a Jew. So what was really interesting about it is LA was where it happened. And it was before the internet really got hopping. So I went to Central Library and found all this stuff. And then I went to this place called Kim's Video, which was like one of those like non-Blockbuster video stores. And there was a rare documentary of footage before Manson became the famous Charles Manson, back when he was Manson the guru, not Manson the serial killer. And that's when Dennis Wilson knew him. So I was able to watch this over and over and over and over again, kind of get the feel of Charlie. And I interviewed Vincent Bugliosi, who wrote the book Helter Skelter, and talked to him for a while. And just read up. There were so many books about him, especially at Central Library in LA. And then I showed up on set, and there were all these gorgeous hippie women around me. And I looked around and, what's with this Beach Boys bullshit? Is the first thing that came in my mind, because the makeup was so good. And I was so involved in this world where I wanted to just hypnotize everybody. I wanted everybody to do acid with me. I wanted to, you know, bring the world together for a race war. You know, that whole thing that he was doing, listening to his music. It was just unbelievable. It was insane too, because, you know, of course he was one of the worst psychopaths in history, but it was a vegetarian. So
there you go.
So was Hitler.
Yeah. That's good company, right? You and Charles Manson.
Yeah. It's funny. Now a lot of people have played him. I actually want to do a Manson night. I want to go to a bar. I want to contact everyone. Stephen Railsback, I know from the Actors Studio. Scott Hayes, whom I knew from another movie, played Manson in a James Franco movie. I want to get them all together. I want to go to a bar. I just want to have like a Manson night. It would be fun. So yeah, that was like my first entree into television. From there, I just kind of worked and worked and worked and worked and sort of built up my career. You know, it's taken me 30 years to become an overnight success, for the which I'm tremendously grateful. I don't know if I would have been ready 20 years ago. You know, I mean, also I do voiceovers, you know, I do all sorts of voices.
How did you actually get into like voice acting for video games and whatnot?
Well, there are certain kinds of people. For example, there are certain kinds of people who like all their lives have wanted to jump off a cliff with wings on.
I'm one of those.
You're one of those?
Yeah, definitely.
Dude, I would never do that. You may not want to get on in front of 2,000 people and do 45 minutes of material. I've actually talked with a French paratrooper. He's like, how do you do this? It's so scary. I'm like, dude, jump out of a plane, right? My whole life, I've been in front of a mirror. I've been doing voices. You know, I've been playing with things. They show up in my act. And then I took a class when I was in New York City, a voiceover class. And it started with commercials. And if there are any aspiring actors, voiceover people in here, really the smartest thing you can do, and nobody does this anymore, I don't think, cord 2 hours of daytime TV and you pull all the commercials from it. And then I stuck them all together and voices that were like mine. And I listened to them over and over and over again. I learned how commercial delivery was done. I learned that if you're selling an Audi, it's a different kind of sale than if you're selling a Toyota. It's a different kind of voice. Or is it a Dodge truck? You know, what is it? And then cartoons I've always wanted to do. You know, a few years ago, it was between me and two other guys to play the voice of Mickey Mouse. Oh, hey, everybody, WWSD, you're my favorite guys. You know, I love that world. I've loved cartoons my whole life. And it's just a certain kind of person. And video games, my gosh. I'm a computer nerd. I don't know if you guys know this, but I've been doing computer graphics since I was like 7. My father, he's a bipolar quantum physicist. That's interesting. But he had this Hewlett-Packard 9845C, which had, get this is amazing, 256 colors. It was cutting Edge back in the early 80s. And I just learned BASIC and I learned how to program. And then like games, the original Castle Wolfenstein, Wizardry on the Apple computer. So I played video games a lot. And then Bungie came out with Marathon. I don't know if you remember that. And then eventually it became Halo. And then just the sky opened up. These first person experiences, these immersive experiences, which quite frankly make more money than movies do, where people actually make some decisions. They have autonomy in these worlds. They're not being told what to do. And I really like them, although I don't play any games where I kill people. I definitely appreciate the money. I appreciate the work. I believe in a different path for humanity. But the, you know, I got to be in the first fully immersive VR first-person shooter, Medal of Honor, where like literally, if you want to shoot figuratively, metaphorically, allegorically, if you want to throw a grenade, you actually do this, like you do the motion. So, you know, and you could turn around and like, of course, guess what I play? Ja, was mache ich hier? Ich mache alles auf Deutsch. And when you hear like these scary voices like coming at you, one of them's me, you know. What I love about these things is like you die in so many horrible ways. Okay, do it like you're being stabbed. Do it like you're on fire. You know, just, it's just, you're just playing. You're just playing. It's too bad I don't smoke weed. It would be even more fun. One of the interesting things about the collaborative efforts about video games is, you know, then they go for 2 years before you ever see it. Because the number of man hours, woman hours, I don't know, what do I say now? Person hours is extraordinary on these games. And I've also done the mocap stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You get all dotted up. Also, I've been a Star Wars fan ever since 1977. I got to do two Star Wars. Dude, I played the stupidest stormtrooper on the planet. It was like, what? Huh? You know, And then I got to play a droid. I got to play a droid and a different one. And that to me is just like working with ILM, like, you know, it's going to be awesome. So yeah, it's more work. Yeah, you know, people are like, it's really hard to get work. Yes, it is hard to get work. There's actually more work. There are 570 live action things in production right now. 20 years ago, people said, oh, it's all reality. It's not all reality right now. It is really good scripted stuff. Plus this amazing world of video games, which pretty soon is going to be tied to AI and then the game's going to change. Plus, you know, AR, that's going to change everything. I should get into advertising right now. Basically, pretty soon you guys are going to be driving down the street with your AR glasses on, and you're going to see an ad that's directly focused on the preferences on your phone because you're in the proximity. And someone is going to rent that billboard space to someone to show those ads. And it's probably going to be green, right? You're going to be like, what are all these green things doing around? And this is a new world we're going
to
be in.
I'm so not looking forward to that dystopia. Yeah. I'll be brushing my teeth and like ads will come on for like fucking toothpaste and shit. Like, what a fucking miserable experience.
Right on your mirror. Do you like your toothpaste? Would you like it a little more minty?
Yeah. 9 out of 10 dentists recommend.
So that's, you know, I actually love technology. I'm a big technology file. And people are like, science is stupid. I hate science. I'm going to tweet about it, my handheld supercomputer, and have it transmitted wirelessly to the internet where it's stored on servers that are powered by Jesus. You know, no, I really believe technology is fascinating and also terrible. I mean, we existed for 50,000 years before technology. How much longer do we have?
Right.
You know.
I mean, you probably have a lot better understanding what science actually is with father being a quantum physicist.
Well, my mother was an aeronautical engineer during the space age. Oh, wow. So there's that. She worked for IBM for quite some time. Then she was one of the first team who worked for the New York Times pulling news off the AP wire. And then she just said, you know, screw all this. I want to be a doctor like my father. So she went away to medical school. Didn't mess me up at all when I was 4. And Dad was a material science metallurgist. Then he became a painter for a number of years, and now he's retired and he does quantum physics all day, right in that house right over there.
How did your parents take you going into the field of acting and comedy and all that when they're such heavy duty scientists and doctors and whatnot?
Boy, are they proud of me.
Yeah.
Mom was always like, why can't you stand up straight? You don't want to hunch like your cousin Billy. don't pull at your nose. You don't want to nose like your cousin Billy. You know, my cousin Billy's now a bond trader. She's like, what? Why can't you be more like your cousin Billy? God rest her soul. You know, they were very supportive. You have to understand, my mother decided to be an aeronautical engineer, and her mother told everyone she was a math teacher. Take that in for a second. My mom turned down Mensa. She's not really, you know, why would I ever join a club that would want me as a member? You know, that kind of thing. So she walked her own path. My father grew up poor in Chicago, son of a trombonist. He played with the big bands. Dad had no money. He loved science. He was an all-American swimmer. He decided that he was going to do metallurgy. You know, when he was in college, he decided to work for a foundry because he could learn more about pouring metals into molds and stuff. And like when people had like no good working conditions, like people would lose their limbs in a pot of molten iron, you know, which is terrible. But they wanted me to do what I was passionate about. They really did. And I'm so grateful that they came to all my shows. You know,
it's awesome.
When my senior thesis, they drove up to college. When I had a play in Exeter, New Hampshire, and they were 6 hours away in New York, they came. You know, they came to the Montreal Comedy Festival. They were very, very supportive, and not everybody gets that. Yeah, I consider myself very fortunate to do what I love. And my parents were really there for me when I was growing up. I don't know where they are now.
I'm sure you're pushing your children to be doctors and lawyers and really exactly they now don't
actually they both want to be therapists. It's probably because cool. They've seen me and my wife together.
I want to help everyone else not be this.
No, they I think they both want to be therapists. But my daughter actually told me couple of weeks ago, she's like, what if I don't want to go? We've been saving, by the way, for college since they were born, like putting away every month, starting with my mom and then me. And a couple of weeks ago, she said, what if I don't want to go to college? I said, that is fine with me. Absolutely. I will pay the taxes on your, 529, and I will travel around the world. She said, wait, don't I get the money? I'm like, nah, that's your education fund. Like, okay, I'll go to college. I'll go to college.
I'm kind of interested in your opinion on this. It sounds like you've spent some time with like Eastern thought a little bit, and you sound like you're a Jim Carrey fan.
Yes, I am.
Right. So there's kind of this idea like an Eastern thought personality and ego that's just as much an accumulation as your body is or something like that. And like our true identity is kind of beyond our personality. Mm-hmm. I imagine that being an actor, you kind of like you spend so much time in like building personalities, building identities, inhabiting them. Like I'm wondering if that truth kind of is more cogent to you, but like from doing all of that. And I bring up Jim Carrey because of when he was playing Andy Kaufman, you know, how he kind of had a dissolution of his ego and like just kind of became something else. And it seems like that's kind of persisted with him for a while. I was just wondering what your opinion is on that kind of phenomena.
Okay. I love that you asked that question. I think it's akin to music. I see a role like a song. Really, it's like a song. This happened to me recently. My scene partner in a TV show was holding a real knife at me. And I was coming in from the hug. She go, wait, that's not the prop knife. I'm like, thank you. Right. She saved my life. Right. Because even though we were in the scene, she had the understanding that even though her character may or may not use this knife, she's an actress and safety first. Aside from that 11th level, we're playing a song and we're totally into the song and we're giving ourselves over to that song. And that song, by the way, isn't for the rest of our lives, because if you're a musician, you might write 100 of them. When you're playing that song, you are giving yourself over to it. And that's the same thing as the Eastern religion thing with Andy Kaufman, I think. I think it becomes a bit of a mental illness when one cannot let go of the song. And I dated a woman a while who used to, she was a wonderful human being. She used to actually, her day job, she was a comic. She would read tarot cards at strip clubs. All right. So here, you know, she'd come home like, what's the matter? She's like, all these desperate men. And they would ask all these questions of her, like, are you that stupid? And she would come home. And finally, she had a conversation with a veteran tarot card reader. And the woman said that it'll get a lot easier. What's happening is you're picking up a lot of their energy and you don't have the craft yet to kind of shake it off. And I think that's probably why a lot of us entertainers become drug addicts. A lot of us entertainers become high performance athletes, among other things, that we got to get this song out of our head. And sometimes this song is a really hard one to sing. Julie Garner in the new season of Ozark, There's this 1 minute shot. There's this 1 minute shot of her deciding what she's going to do after her cousin is shot. Anyway, she's trying to figure out what to do. And the camera stays on her for a minute. It's a minute. And by the way, Julie, they say, you know, you don't want to blink when you're on screen. She's actually made an art of blinking. They stay on here for a full minute. And she is just going through something that is like, give the woman an Emmy. It is just beautiful, vulnerable, powerful work. And they cut to the inside of the car, which you know is another setup. They don't have another camera in the car. They wait till they're done with that and they move on. And she's in that same place. You think she's going to drive away? No, they're on her for another 30 seconds. So that day of shooting, and it was probably in the same location, she had to go there all day long. And she had to go to the darkest, deepest, most horrible place of figuring out what to do and making that decision. And then she needed to get on with her night, her day. She needed to eat with a cast or whatever. It took her over. But if she lived with that, she would be in a great deal of pain. You don't get that good by faking it. You get that good by going there. And I think Jim Carrey may have stumbled upon enlightenment through the dissolution of his ego in another person. But fortunately, the recognition at some point that he wasn't Andy Kaufman. And I think that he went, wait a second, if I can disappear, if I can make myself go away, let me sit in this for a while. What is this when there's no Jim Carrey, the movie star? What is this when there's no identity? Who is there? And I think that was the big click for him. But if he kept going down that path, he would still be going, you know, I was mouthing, here I come to save the day.
Yeah.
So, you know, Eastern religion believes that who we are is the observer. I meditate every day. I don't know if you guys do, but I used to meditate 2 hours a day between 4:30 and 6:30 in the morning. Now I do it between 8 and 25 minutes, depending on how long my program
is. What kind of meditation were you doing?
Close my eyes and shut the fuck up meditation.
Okay. Just mindfulness thing.
Yeah. Well, there's mindfulness. I also have this really great app called Mesmerize that I use. Again, being in the martial arts for 25 years as I was, when we enter the dojo, we change our clothes into a gi. So we realize, oh, this is now what we're doing. We're no longer in our day clothes. Then we sit down in seiza, which is a seated position on our knees. It's terrible on a hardwood floor. We close our eyes and we meditate. We clear our minds. We breathe in our nose, out our mouth. And then we bow in, and all of a sudden there's a threshold that's crossed. Like, we're training now. And then in an hour and a half later, you're like, I didn't think about all my bullshit for an hour and a half. This was awesome. Same thing with meditation. What I call the sit down and shut the fuck up meditation is simply this. I close my eyes. I breathe in my nose and out my nose, or breathe in my nose or out my mouth, depending. I get in touch with my body. The Hindus say that the brain is a monkey in a cage with his tail on fire. That was clearly not written by a vegetarian. And the fact is, you start thinking about something. And the whole point of mindfulness is to actually not think about something. But they say, now don't think about a purple elephant. Oops, right? So what I do is I forgive myself. And sometimes I get lost for 5 minutes thinking about, I'm like, blah, 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 not supposed to think about anything. And that's going to happen until the day I die. You know, even the Dalai Lama is human. Even the Dalai Lama goes, oh, I shouldn't have eaten these chickpeas, you know? We all are having a human experience, but who we are is the observer. We're actually able to see ourselves having this experience and go, ah, that is not who I am. I'm this. I'm this potentially everlasting spirit, this absolute truth that can't be defined. Who's observing all that? You know, we talk about relative truths. This is made of metal. And then we talk about absolute truths. Like, Seamus, if I said, who are you? We could be here an hour, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't have an answer.
I'm a dad,
yeah.
Right? I'm a dad. That's who I am. But that's not all I am. I'm a son. True. I'm an actor. True. I'm a martial artist. True. I'm a meditator. True. I'm a computer nerd. True. I'm a lot of things. But that's not who I am. Who I am is the undefinable. You can't define who I am. In order to function, you're going to have to categorically remember things because of social psychology. We have a hierarchy in our brain. So when we see a dog, we know it's a dog. We don't think a schnauzer is different from a poodle, which is different from a Great Dane. So we know they'll all fetch because they're all dogs and we've categorized them. So you can see me as an actor. You can see me as a father if we're at a PTA meeting, but that's not all who I am. So at the end of the day, to come around full circle, the point of meditation is to separate myself and my identity from my thoughts or who I think I am. And also, you ever sit in one place for a while and realize something was asleep?
Oh, yeah. Happens in the bathroom quite a bit.
You don't do that. That doesn't happen when you're meditating.
Right.
because you're constantly aware of your body and how you're aligned. And this is uncomfortable. And that's uncomfortable. That's being in the moment. So mindfulness is really about being the observer and constantly being able to adjust, which, by the way, is flow, which, by the way, is the only way you beat Michael Jordan. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's the void, right?
That's flow. The void. But in order to master the void, you rather either got to be one of those talents that comes along once a generation. You know, for all I know, Julie Garner has zero acting craft. She's just that talented. Kaylee Cuoco may have zero acting craft. She's just that talented. Or she actually does the work to get herself in a flow state and has craft such that on the 17th take, she can do just as good a job as the first take. Because you know what? Her best take, the 14th take, the sound guy screwed up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Eric, we usually ask one last question of our guests. Any words of wisdom for an aspiring actor looking to get into the industry?
Sure. I got a lot of them. But I'm going to tell you my mantra. And this is the best mantra. First of all, we all have superpowers. My superpower is my vulnerability. It just is. I can joke around a lot. I can be, you know, hyperactive and funny. But at the end of the day, my connection to God is my vulnerability. So here's what I say sometimes. Here's my mantra. Let my guard down. Vulnerable. Completely open. Zero concern with anything but being and growth. I have nothing to lose and nothing to gain, but maybe a nugget of wisdom. Know it. Own it. Own that I am the soul to take this space. Be there. Let my guard down and be. Know it. Accept it. Go in and do me. Even when I fuck up, I'm a better me than anybody. Don't try so hard. Just be. Just fuck up as much as I can. Then it will start to happen. Let it go. Let it go. That's a mantra I say when I'm doing acting work. And this is the stuff, and this is stuff actually coined to me by my friend Eddie Kaler. And I have this on my wall too. And this, for all aspiring actors, is something that you may struggle with for a very long time. But this is something to overcome. And if you can overcome this, you can do anything. Dramatic ideas about a part. Your idea about the part or how the guy should talk or what he says or how am I going to say this line? That's 99% of what we see from actors. Trying to put backstory in the line so that the audience knows where they're coming from. We're trying to sell something to the audience. Hey, I'm this character. I don't really believe I'm this character or believe I'm doing the work, but I'm going to act as if I'm doing the work so that I can pull the wool over your eyes and maybe book this audition, right? First of all, you don't have to sell a thing. Don't sell anything. And number two, know the art of the eyeline. While you're being, you can't be all over the place. I know the audience can't see this, but do you see how I'm looking at you guys?
Mm-hmm.
Watch this. See that? Doesn't it look like I'm talking to someone else?
Yeah.
Right? Now watch this. You lost me.
Yeah.
And we're talking a difference of 4 inches. So when there's a big camera in front of me, one time when we were on the flight attendant, I'm in the airplane and I didn't realize that the camera was like this close. It was ridiculous. And I knew I had to be small because it was close. And I kept my stuff small and I'm really glad I did. Because like modern TVs, just that little twitch would be like a story high. Being really aware of where the camera is something you learn over time. And by the way, if you're an actor, use Zoom a lot. Know where your camera is, play with it, watch your auditions, and know you don't have to sell anything. What you have to do is develop a craft because there are a lot of talented people out there. Yeah, in terms of the business. Someone once said, how do I become a successful, famous comedian? I said, dude, I went to Yale. If there were an A to Z of this, I'd be a huge fucking star by now, you know? There's a lot. But in terms of craft, I can talk all day about it.
Yeah. And I think it really comes down to the individual as well. Like they have to, like, you can give all the advice in the world. You can tell them to do this, do that. But like the individual ultimately really has to drive that. So.
Well, not only the individual has to drive that, but which is not only true, but all there is.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we go to a Tom Cruise movie to see Tom Cruise because Tom Cruise is awesome. I don't know what you think about him. I don't know how you feel about his religious beliefs or whatever, but dude, that guy is a movie star. He picks the projects that are just perfect for him and he just crushed it in Tropic Thunder. I'm sorry. He gave one of the funniest performances I've ever seen in my life. Like him or not, think he's Oscar quality or not. He's been nominated for Oscars. He is a beast in this business. And you know what? We go to see Tom, right? We go to see Jack. You know, we go to see Tom Hardy. We go to see Meryl Streep. Like, these people are so that we go to see, hello, who am I being now? You know, everybody knows who that is, right? Yeah. You know, it's very difficult sometimes, you know, to be on screen. You know, we all know who that is. He's unfranchisable. So, like, you got to figure out who that you is. That is just so you, that your Eunice is right up there. And you start with one true sentence.
Eric, it's been an absolute blast having you on the podcast this evening. It's been so fun. Really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Seamus. Such a blast.
Where can our listeners find more of you and your work at?
Check out my Instagram, actually. I'm just getting into Instagram, starting to post off. It's at little ampersand. Of course, anybody under 90 knows that. Eric Pasoja. I'm going to spell it for you. E-R-I-K-P-A-S-S-O-J-A. That's like football pass to OJ, who's out of jail, A. Eric Pasoja. You can check me out there on Facebook, too, and Twitter. Also, I got a new music video coming out.
Oh, cool.
Called Guru Money. Definitely follow Instagram for that. It's out of festivals now. And also check out, I can't say too much about it, but check out next season of Hunters on Amazon.
Yeah.
I'm in there. Right. Also, the new Overwatch video game. Check that out. And also Diablo 4. I'm doing a voice in that too. So it's going to be really fun.
Nice.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, we really definitely appreciate talking to you tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, guys. And thank you for letting me be serious. I know a lot of people, you know, when they get a comic on, they want them to be funny the whole time. But I got to tell you, I don't have to be.
No. I felt a lot of your like, a lot of it was really enlightening. And, like, a lot of times we don't get a lot of that kind of conversation.
It's cool to have, like, some genuineness, you know.
Thank you. I think it's genuinity.
Thank you. Genuinity.
Yeah. Are you embarrassing me in front of the fucking guest, Seamus?
No, I don't know what to it. No.
I think genuineness, it works, but it's not a great word. I'll agree with you on that.
Well, look up the word better words. You see, I learn something every day, and most of it involves porn. No, let me see. I don't know. It's not giving it to me. Hey, listeners, hey, would you post to us the proper way to use genuine as a genuineness, genuinity, Generation X? Gen Pop, that's where I'm going to be next week.
All right. Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. Great guy.
We keep getting like long-winded people, but I do love it.
No, it's, I love it. I love it.
Yeah,
this guy talked about what he actually does. This is cool.
But no, Eric was cool as fuck.
Great,
definitely very very insightful guy. Definitely a different take on a lot like than we normally talk to with actors. I don't mean that in any disrespectful way. He definitely reminded me of talking to your dad a little bit.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
I think so. You mean he's an intelligent, insightful, deep individual? Then I agree. Yes.
But no, he reminded me like the spirit. There's really spiritual people that are also really cool and all. Like just as like I
mean, you're like some people who are spiritual aren't assholes.
I meant like a cool like a personality or demeanor. Like they're
right.
Like this guy is like he'd be like the cool kid in school kind of like he's, gotcha. He seems like a cool guy.
Yeah, he's not a nerd. He's not like a
He's like some crunchy fucking weirdo.
He's not one of them granola guys.
I do find it interesting though, like him not abandoning comedy, but putting comedy down to pursue something else. Like a lot of times you talk to comedians, like that's all they want to do is stand up. Like that's, or they're like, I guess you get to a certain point where you want to branch off possibly, but like majority of the comedians we talk to is like, that's all they want to be known for is like a good stand up. They want to stand up like 5 days a week. They want to do as much stand up as possible. And it's interesting where he's like, yeah, I want to do acting. I love acting more. I want to really focus on acting. I'm going to put a shelf this.
I feel like comedy was kind of like a quest for him. It was like a side quest. He went and learned a bunch of things that made him a better actor. And like acting was his real love. Seth Rogen said that one time. He was like, I thought I wanted to be a stand-up comedian until I got around other stand-up comedians. And I realized I didn't want to be a comedian as much as these people did.
I mean, it is a hard lifestyle, and like he even acknowledged that. Like you're going to be like a open micer or like a city comedian for so like to level up or to like grow. you do have to go on the road, you have to travel, you have to tour. Like, it's just the natural progression of comedy. Like, Bert Kreischer fucking tours like 250 days out of the year, like, in, like, every fucking city.
Some of those guys, I wonder if their marriages would work if they weren't touring all the time. You know what I mean?
Bert's definitely one of them. Like, it's funny, like, listen to, like Leanne, like, just like, oh, can you just go fucking back on tour kind of thing. And, like, even his kids are like, it's actually kind of sad when he, like, talks about that, or his kids is always like, I like you more when you're not here, kind of. This fucking breaks my heart personally as a
father. And I think about that too. It's funny sometimes, but sometimes it's like
but very rough lifestyle. And I do think people romanticize it a bit more than they should. This is very, very tough. It's like the same as like touring musicians. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's not for everyone, but like, people see it like in movies or like on TV show, like, they like, oh, I would love to do that, but like, it has to be so fucking miserable. And not even just that, but like, also like, lonely to some extent, especially with family and shit.
Yeah, you got to give up a lot. Might not have to give up a lot to be really good at something, you know what I mean? Do we want to mention that I just did this hot chip challenge before we like fucking like ran into this? Because I'm acting different, you know, I'm acting a little different than I normally do. I'm a little more whoa, you know what I mean? A little more
If you want to find out why Seamus is acting a little whoa, as he so well put it, you can check out our Patreon. Patreon.com/WWSD podcast.
Yeah. And
you can see Seamus do the one chip challenge with our friend of the podcast, Eric.
If you want to hear about how I really feel about the Jews, like, sign up to our Patreon.
Yeah, not just eating fucking ghost pepper chips, but also bashing the Holocaust. You get it all at the Patreon at the WWSD podcast.
Bashing the Holocaust. I think everybody bashes the Holocaust when you put it that way. I think the Holocaust was horrible. Let's roast the Holocaust.
Thank you all for listening. If you would like to support the WWSD podcast, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/WWSD_podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Yeah, but also, you know, depending on the movie, I mean, you know, my mom always said, life is like a box of chocolates. That was Jeffrey Dahmer, right?
Yeah, 100%. No, it was Manson.
People are like, it was Manson.
Yeah. Right, girls?
Great musician.
When you're done being witchy, eat them.